Between the stirrup and the field, they called his name. There was a flash of sky through the horse's legs, so close to his face, before his shoulders sang out at the hurt, and his cheek on the other side slapped the hard grass and rang yellow lights through his eyes. He was tumbling and turning, curled in on himself and trying to breathe, and his name spun into a wall around the sides of the jolting paddock, first the linden tree and the house roof in an island of sunlight, and then, as his arms fell back against the earth, the stone pile and the gate into the woods, and then, while his face jutted along the grass and clods flew around him, the long shadows shuttling up the hill, all blurring under the horse's belly into a green and black and yellow wall that was climbing the sky. The earth was hollow beneath the runaway hooves. He was dragged on his shoulders now. He could see his boot in the stirrup that would not let go, but everything was becoming loose and soft. The wool that had grown from his name was a long sigh closing around him. The colors were fading. He felt his back spring outwards. He was almost as high as the saddle for a moment, and then he was staring at Willowar's front hoof with its bright new shoe, the 10 square-headed nails hammered in just last week, the 2 shoulder nails that Chris Lamont said did all the real work, the clinch nail, the clench nail. The clods were flying into the sky, the clench nail, heavy and feathered and black. His name was closing round him again. He was turning and turning. Behind his wide eyes he could see the worm gear of his father's press beginning to move, a dim shadow, the clinch nail, the clench nail. His father's hands must be gripping the wheel. They would count together. It took 7 turns, the clench nail, to bring the rollers down onto the bed. The worm gear turned and ran downwards, yet it never moved. There were sounds like the school orchestra tuning up behind the wall and the shadowy worm gear. Something was creaking, something was twanging. And Daddy's eyes stared down through the wheel, pale blue eyes that stared down at the bed but could not see him. The clinch nail, the clench nail. Daddy's hands turned as if he was steering a car. And a wide, cold voice said, "One." The body brush was moving in quick circles along the horse's flank with a sound like feet in dry grass, leaving dark furrows on the sweat-drenched coat. The girl's hand was pale under the brush strap, and her face was pale against the horse's shoulder. In the gloom of the box stall, he watched his sister's face as he never had before, and saw how young she was, as though the 6 years between them had galloped away and more, and he had grown older than her. She worked towards the horse's rump, following the grain of its coat with her strokes, dipping into the contrary whorl of hairs by its haunch. Her breath was held in as she brushed, as if the one thing on her mind was to do this job perfectly. But the air in the barn was charged with madness. The edges of things seemed ready to crack. The horse's eye rolled back at her as she worked down its thigh. The nerves in its skin leaped away from the brush and sent tremoring waves through its leg. The smells in the barn were like parts in a music. They wove and surfaced through each other and flowed and broke apart. Willowar's breath blended in with the hay and manure, but his sweat cut into the air like his staring eye and conjured the taste of leather and sour brass from the tack room. Around Skye's face, the pale fragrances of her bedroom, dove and finesse and teen spirit, with piss and the broken straw by her feet. She was scouring the brush with the curry comb in short, angry strokes away from her body, standing below the high, dusty window. When she dragged the brush hard across the crib rail, the horse edged away from her, trampling the cement floor, yanking at its tether. She turned through the hollow alarms of its hooves, speaking softly, to soothe. She said, "Willowar, Willowar, easy now, easy." And then Willowar became a lament, and she went crying, her arms to the horse's neck, tugging the great face down against hers. The gelding's ears went back for a moment, and then his nose dug into her chest and lifted up gently at her armpit. Her cheek leaned against his, but her fist began to beat softly upon the blaze between his eyes. Her eyes were closed, the lashes dark and moist like a baby's, the smattering of freckles below them, the start of a dreaded blemish by her lip, the tiny bones of her fist. Willowar let out a huge sigh through his nostrils. She dragged the sleeve of her jacket across her eyes and brought the horse blanket from the crib, throwing it over him and unfolding it front and back. When she crouched at the horse's chest to latch the front buckles, he bent and nuzzled her crown, the wide soft lips straying across her hair. She ducked round under his belly, tugging the back straps up through the wide rear legs along the inside of his thighs. Skye, in her tailored riding jacket with the velvet lapel flashes, her Christmas pride and joy. When no one was there but him, she would still canter instead of running when they went down to the barn. Skye wanted to be a horse. The barn was turning, receding around him. Unless he was turning in the still, dizzy barn. It was a stage on an iron spiral staircase, like the one in Auntie Cat's hall, and Skye was below him in the tack room, sponging the harness. The saddle sat on its tree beside her, the gleaming stirrup drawn up to its flap. A hatch was rasping in the wind, somewhere up in the barn roof. She was holding the bridle, drawing the long reins carefully out through her fingers. Behind the partition, Willowar chewed at his feed. The voice that could not be Daddy's was counting, 2, from the haymow. "He mustn't die," she said, over and over. "He mustn't be dead." There were dark sounds and light ones. The water lapped in his ears. His mother's bare arm cradled his shoulders. They had taken him out of his clothes and were bathing him. She carried the water up to his face in her left hand, spilling it carefully across his forehead and down his cheeks, caressing his eyebrows with her thumb. Her fingertips traced his nostrils, his lips, his eyelids, his ears. The polished nails that would tick on the piano keys whispered across his skin. Her hand was at the waterline now, upon his chest, reaching towards his arm, and her hair fell down over him, spreading out on the water. "Jimmy," she said, "tie my hair back, please." His father was somewhere behind her in the pink, steamy room. Just a pair of hands with the signet ring on one finger, drawing the hair back, fumbling beside her neck. Her pupils were huge and shiny. They had swallowed the green of her eyes, and he watched himself, pale and floating within them. Inside the water, the flow of the bath tap trundled down. The water was hot, but it could not reach in through his skin. His mother was squeezing and turning his hand, her fingers pressed and kneaded through his, as if she were counting, or making him piece by piece out of clay. Her hand climbed his side and swept slowly across his ribs and along his belly. She held him between his legs, scooping and cleaning him, and then, as she lifted, the sudden release of her breath shuddered upon his chest. The tap water beat in his ears, but there was a thin sound, too, of the open plug draining. The water escaped in a yellow spiral. He could feel it, tugging at his heel, trying to drag a thin stream of himself down with it. And Mummy must understand, for her palm slid down over his shin to his ankle, and she lifted his feet from the danger, working her fingers into his toes, possessing him. She was talking to him, or singing. He could hear her clearly on the other side of the water. She was taking him back to the time they had baths like this every night. But then she turned suddenly, and his face was lifted back into the air, and her voice was the ugly, scratchy one that came out when she fought with Daddy. "For Christ's sake, Jimmy, would you close the door? There's a draught like a knife." He heard the door shut. Was Daddy shut in or shut out? And she drew him against her again. She pretended he was her baby, hers and no one else's. His head was pressed up to her chin, and through his lips, against the soft skin of her neck, he could hear the sounds, that came up from her heart as she rocked back and forth. But he could not taste her skin any more. The smell of her powder, the lemon breath of her hairspray had gone away. The bathroom had lost its smell. The memories lived in the smells. His neck and his knees and his elbows began to feel tight and lazy. She must have known, for she let him go all at once and turned away, sitting alone on the floor with her back against the bath. Perhaps she was crying behind that metal wall, but he drifted and settled in the water, his ears back down in the world of dark, hollow noises. His elbows knocked against the sides of the bath. The engine rumble of the tap died away. But the tight yellow whirlpool was tugging at him again, with that voice behind it crying, "Three, three, three!" Upside down, with the maple tree through an oval window tossing its branch tops at the sky, the old leaves coming off in twos and threes, sliding the way that you do in dreams, their rusty sails and fingers twirling towards him and out of sight. The little window was crusted and dull, if there was only some rain to wash it clean. And at once there were raindrops splashing and crawling through the dirt, and he thought, wind in the leaves, and the leaves began streaming and tumbling from their branches. Clouds for the rain, he thought, birds in the sky, an avalanche of cumulonimbus, cumulonimbus, cumulonimbus swept past the lower branches, piling up fast, with a long skein of geese fleeing before it across the window, their dog cries tattered by the wind. He sent up a kite, though a voice inside him said, "Don't be too greedy," and watched its blue wings tremble and slap at the air. But he could not control the kite. It went out beyond him. It was trying to tug him with it into the rain. It lifted and dived and sliced back at the wind, and its line snagged in the tree and came crumpling. It hung there at the edge of his sight, pelted by leaves and rain, snapped up and dropped by the wind till its skin began tearing away. The window shivered and lurched off with him, dragging the storm clouds away from the branches. Everything rocked and settled. He was a traveller. It was like going home at night in the car, waiting to fall asleep in the seat beside Sky, knowing that when you awoke, the time and the distance would have passed, you would be home. And sleep would come, delicious, as the sounds around you, Mummy and Daddy in front, the radio music, Sky singing under her breath, drifted in and out, getting mothy and dim, your eyelids slipping down, moving through the night in a warm, safe room, the nicest thing in the world. He could hear hooves beating on the road. Someone was galloping by beside them, shouting, something loud and fierce and indistinct. A highwayman came riding, riding, riding. All night long when the stars are out, why does he gallop and gallop about? But it was not dark after all. Up through the little window there were other trees now, looking in on him and falling away, with more lining up to gaze down at him, dripping the slow grey rain down the window as they peered in, with the thick clouds behind them, though the wind had died out. What were they thinking? What were they saying to each other? These were the trees along the driveway. There was the tamarack where the blue jays had nested, looming in with its wet, witchy fingers, brushing the glass as the car speeded up. They were talking about him, and he wanted to stay and listen, so he must somehow get to the window and look back before they reached the gate. The hoofbeats were so close. They were racing with the car. The man was shouting again. They were going too fast. Gravel spat up against the floor. He was pressed to the streaming glass. The house stared back from the end of the trees, with Mummy and Daddy and Sky standing in front, crying out to him, but the rain was in their voices. The car dipped and swayed. The hooves beat alongside. The invisible horseman yelled from on high, like a command in a dream, but a command full of fear. "Four! Four!" urging the wheels along. They were at the gate. He reached back towards the house. When things dreamed, nothing happened. Things were untroubled, a slow gathering in of memories that stood there, themselves. Nothing had to change. This was where he belonged, staring out patiently, as a tree, living or dying, could just stare out, as the walls of his room stared out at each other. He would stay here forever. The wheels in the glass-fronted clock would run down and be still, like everything else. The dust would settle. It did not matter when the door swung inwards. He scarcely noticed. Their voices were vague and muffled. Auntie Cat with her arm round Mummy's waist, like people in a brown photograph from long ago. They came in and left the door open, and the things just stared with him, contained and unaffected. Auntie Cat was picking up clothes from the floor and off the bed, folding them over her arm. She moved through the room, and he wished she would not. He did not want her looking at everything. Things were not meant to be disturbed. She was picking him out of his things. Once he had sat in her house, in the carved chair under the spiral iron staircase, with a skein of aquamarine soft wool looped over his outstretched hands, while she sat before him, smiling, on the footstool, and wound the wool off into a big ball in her lap. Her round blue eyes that were always smiling, but looked into your thoughts. She ran her hand along the edge of the dresser, and his skin crawled. She fingered the wooden horse. He could feel himself being drawn out. She would wind him in and fold him over her arm. He wanted to say, "Go away, you're a witch, you're not my auntie," for she wasn't. Sky said Auntie Cat had had two husbands, and the last one had been Daddy. "You're not my auntie," he said, his voice thin and spiteful in his own ears, but she paid no attention. Her hand closed upon the horse. "I shall sleep here tonight," she said, with that wicked, strong kindness of hers. "That will be best for everyone." He found his own horror in his mother's face, but she bent her head in submission and turned away. Why did she listen? He would not be left with Auntie Cat's eyes and greedy fingers. He had to go out with Mummy, trying to cry in her ear to change her mind. But he was lost in the shadows as soon as she closed the door behind them. The stairwell was a funnel of bars and reflections and false, unfamiliar angles. He was lost and thin and angry. He drifted too close to things to see them properly, and the only light was down over Daddy's shoulder, where his hand moved upon the paper. The hand was angry, too. It sketched quick ruffles of brown chalk, and then cut into them with slashes of pen and ink. Daddy's breath came loud through his nose, and he pushed the paper around and away and pulled out another sheet. The black strokes were finding a hand down at the right of the paper, and the chalk near the circle swirled around three crooked holes in an egg. The hand grew stronger, its palm faced out, and the bony lines of its wrist slanted into the page. The paper lay upon the bed of the press, with the rollers and the thick worm gear black at the edge of the lamp's light. Daddy lit a cigarette and stared at the paper. When he blew the smoke out, the worm gear seemed to be turning. He pushed his chair back and went off into the shadows to stand by the dark window. The picture was going to be Skye's photograph, the one she took by the barn when he had his temper, when they told him to go in for bed and he didn't know she had the camera. "Oh, you'll love this when you're 13," she mocked when she got the prints. He was wailing. His hand was stuck out, his mouth pulled into a stupid, lopsided hole. "Poor baby," she had teased him for days, until Mummy got firm with her, and then she had set it in a frame on her dresser so he'd see it each time he passed her open door. But Daddy had just smiled and winked at him, and a few weeks later had traded it from her for a drive to the trotting races, and the next day he had called him into his studio, and they'd burned it in the wood stove. And now he was bringing it back to life, out of the flames, out of his memory, in this room drained of its smells that was the only light in the house. Daddy ripped the paper in two and crumpled it away. He bent over the copper plate on the bed. The metal curled away from the point of the Buren, 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 Daddy's Newfoundland pencil, under the clever hands that could turn things back to front. For the plate was a mirror, he said, and the mirror always shows you back to front. That's why photographs look so strange. The rollers waited, and the worm gear winked at the gleam of the Buren, and pretended to turn and start pressing him flat on the bed. 5, it said, like a back-to-front echo of Daddy's voice. Inside his room, not one thing was quite where it should be. Auntie Cat sat on the bed, in her nightie, and everything had been moved just a little. The window was open, and her clothes were folded on the chair. In a small half-circle beside her were his seashells and his compass, and the parrot's feather from over his door, and the arrowhead from Oregon. On her lap were his pajamas from under the pillow. There had been tears on her cheeks, but her eyes were bright, and she was whisper-singing as she picked up each thing in turn. He could not feel her fingers any more, but she was stealing him all the same. There was a soft double knock at the door. "Yes," she said, and put the pajamas on the pillow. Daddy stood in the doorway, staring at her. "Cat," he said. "Oh, Jimmy," she murmured. He stood there. "You should be with Ailsa," she told him. His hand played with the doorknob. "Ailsa's with Skye." Auntie Cat turned back to the treasures on the bedspread. "In that case, my darling, you should be with yourself." He watched her gather the trophies one by one into her left hand. Then he turned away, and the door shut quietly behind him. Auntie Cat sat still for a very long time before she began to put the things back, almost, but not exactly, where they had been. There was no use fighting. As she moved across to the window, the room shrank in behind her. She leaned out on the sill, over the bare top twigs of the damson tree. "Shoo," she said, her kind face filling the window. "Shoo, now. Be off with you." The voice said, "Six," and the night began tearing like a shirt on a rusty nail. His ears were filled with the sounds of seashells, their outside ticking, whispering slither, their inside water and wind, and echoes that couldn't escape. There was so much light that everything was a mirror and hurt his eyes, the dunes and their manes of shining grass, and the sand by his face, and the white, yellow sky. The sky covered everything, but everything sounded closed in. Beyond the dunes, the waves were pouring, like one unbroken wave, and there was something drumming inside the waves or in front of them. There was a rider on the beach, galloping off but getting no further away. The hooves echoed out through the ground. The sand grains danced on the dunes as if on a drum skin. The sky shivered under the hoofbeats. The only thoughts here came in on their own and left. You could not follow them, and you did not want to. There were people behind him somewhere, but it did not matter. It did not matter. It did not matter. A little shadow began at the edge of the sky, and there was a man coming over the dunes with a door in his hands, held slantwise like a kite. He walked slowly, in a wavering line, as though looking for his way down the slope, and his feet crunched louder in the sand as he drew near. He settled the door in front of him, upright, so that it blocked out half the sky, and began to tap upon it. He was hidden behind it, but his left hand was holding it steady at the top, while his other hand tapped with a hammer. There was no handle on it, or latch, or keyhole. It was the plainest door there could be. The hammer stroke stopped, and there was Chris Lamont's face looking around the side, with his thick eyebrows and his broken-rimmed green cap. He nodded and gave a slow wink, and then picked up the door again and laid it down on the sand close by. The nails stood up from the wood, bright and new. One by one the hammer came down on them and drove them in, top and bottom and sides, At each stroke the door stood up a little, and the earth lifted up to meet it. Now the door stood open just a crack, and Chris Lamont was staring in, out of the light, with his hammer's head between his thumb and finger, and two square-headed nails held in his teeth. The door closed too. The pour of the waves was shut out, and the seashells whispered and settled against each other. The hammer beat at the door. The clinch nail, the clinch nail. The hooves raced by. The feathery clods of earth flew up against the door. And seven, seven, seven rang the iron gates of heaven.